Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that is devoted to those of you who have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, that they're all counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next couple of hours, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. It was interesting to watch, and a friend sent me the video clip of it, Democratic presidential candidate Barry Sanders. I don't know if anybody's told Barry that, to be a presidential candidate in the United States, Bernie Sanders, that you do need to look alive. This guy looks like an unmade bed, and he has all of the fire, all of the enthusiasm, all of the charisma of a slug. I mean, wow. It's amazing that such a guy could have had such a long career in politics. But anyway, he was holding one of these pep rallies for his campaign, and just this enormous group of disrespectful and unruly, loudmouth, and about 95% African-American protesters. I don't know if they were activists, they were protesters. Anyway, they came in and they decided that they didn't want to hear what the presidential candidate had to say. They wanted to give them a piece of their, well, I can't say mind, because I'm not sure anybody was thinking. And they screamed Black Lives Matter. And no matter what the politicians attempted to do, and these are bleeding heart liberals that even Bernie said, you know, over the past 50 years, I've sacrificed my entire political career to civil rights legislation. And he kept on looking at these activists, protesters, as if, God, get them out of here. They disgust me. And they said, you know, since you obviously don't want to hear anything I have to say, I'll just leave. And they continue to be more belligerent and shouting. And if somebody were to say, listen, Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, all, and they just shot him down. No, all that they cared about was Black Lives Matter. Allegedly, they have gotten their political giddy-up from the fact that white police officers have killed a number of black folks, some criminals, some not. And so their view is that the police are racist. And we've discussed this at length in this program. There is a racial element to crime. If crime is perpetrated between a white and a black, it is 90% more likely that the perpetrator will be black and the victim will be white. Those are just the facts. And the amount of crime perpetrated per capita by African Americans, if you go through all major crime groups, is much higher than the per capita rate for whites. Those are just the facts. But in terms of justice, the American justice system is ever so slightly less inclined to convict a black criminal, considering the same evidence and same crime, then they are a white criminal, and they're ever so slightly more likely to give the black criminal, if convicted, a slightly longer sentence. So the two offset, and justice is blind as it relates to race. But what this does prove is that this process of which the African-American community in particular was provided entitlements in the Great Society and given all manner of civil rights benefits did not work. It has made a bad situation worse, and the uncivilized behavior of these protesters was a good example of why this has not worked. Turning to the next item in the news that was sent to me by a friend, a morning after the deadly attacks on the military recruiting centers in Chattanooga by the irate Muslim, in, this is actually in Haram, Georgia, as opposed to Chattanooga. A bunch of, they just, I guess there was ever a depiction of, look at me, I'm a redneck. I mean, wow. These were Caucasians, but they were not Caucasians you'd want to meet at a dark alley late at night. Anyway, they strapped, guns to their side, and they went into, they're standing outside of the recruiting center, for photo ops, I guess. And this was their quote. To think that the people who are supposed to protect and serve are unable to protect and serve, and protect themselves, said the gunned, militia member. So if us, the citizens who carry permits are able to help protect them, then that's what we're gonna be able to do. Now, I read that exactly as she said it. So if us, the citizens who carry permits, are able to help protect them, that's what we're gonna be able to do. Scott, I've long felt that the single biggest problem in America was the infiltration of political correctness in academia and in the media and in politics, where generations now, and particularly the last two generations, have been rendered incapable of exercising good judgment, that they're unable to think, that rather than being educated, they're indoctrinated.
Well, it's definitely allowed for feelings to, how I feel has become more important than facts and actually using reason.
But we've lost the ability to speak. So if us, the citizens who carry permits,
well, that's because
are able to help protect them, that's what we're going to be able to do?
Because sometimes when you say things, it hurts people's feelings, Craig. And then, well, I can't have my feelings hurt. So, and that's what political correctness
but
is.
But this is just stupid.
It is. Oh, I 100% agree.
If you can't talk, you ought not be carrying a gun. If you can't string words together, then there's something tells me that your judgment isn't sufficient for you to make a determination of who to shoot and who not to shoot with that gun.
Well, be very careful there. A lot of people are in the military.
Oh, my goodness. What have we done? These were adults. I mean, they were adults. They were required for a certain number of years to be in the educational system. It obviously failed them.
Yeah. Well, no, I agree with you, though. Political correctness is horrible and stupid and
devastating in terms of people's ability to think, to speak, to communicate in an intelligent way, to process information. Wow. Well, this was also sent to me by a friend. The night before, it says a gunman. They don't like saying his name all that much, but he was Mohammed Yusuf Abdul Aziz, killed the five U.S. service personnel in Tennessee. He sent a text message linking to a religious verse about declaring war, reports say. A religious verse. Why can't they say a Quranic verse? You know, why would they not say a Quranic verse? I mean, I understand that Islam is the most vicious of religions, and I understand that those in the media that have been the high priests of political correctness that lives and thrives in the media wants to bury all religion. And so this notion that they could just say a religious voice probably makes them feel very good about their advancement of political correctness, which is hateful of religion. While I'm hateful of religion, I do so factually. But if you're going to be reporting, why not report accurately and say, linking to a Quranic verse about war? Well, here is the verse. It is from the 38th, this is called the 38th Hadith But the fact is that while the Quran is hadith, the Quran doesn't have verses of like this. Anyway, there's the quote that he linked to. Allah the Almighty has said, whoever acts with enmity, that enmity would be hatred, towards a friend of mine, I will indeed declare war against him. Nothing endears my servant to me more than doing what I have made obligatory upon him to do. And my servant continues to draw nearer to me with super rugulatory prayers so that I shall love him. When I love him, I shall be his hearing, which he shall hear, and his sight, which he shall see, and his hands, which he shall hold, and his feet, which he shall walk. And if he asks something of me, I shall surely give it to him, for he takes refuge in me, and I shall certainly grant it of him. Now, the fact of the matter is this wasn't from the Quran, and shouldn't have been declared as Hadith 38, because the Hadith are not numbered in that way. There is no Quran verse that ever speaks of Allah loving an individual, but think of the context of this. This is said, whoever acts with hatred towards a friend of mine, I will indeed declare war against him. And Allah is saying that he's going to endear himself to the servant, the slave, who does what is obligatory upon him. The only obligatory task on a Muslim is to be a jihadist. So Allah is fond of the jihadist who hates. And it is the hating jihadist that engenders the love of his deity. So with the Quran having hundreds of war verses, in fact, the whole eighth surah of the Quran is a declaration of war. How stupid do you have to be as a Muslim to quote a hadith that's not even part of the big four? There's four collection of hadith that were chronicled within 200 years of Muhammad's death. Only four. This didn't come out of any one of those four. The four are, of course, Bukhari, Muslim, Ishaq, and Tabari. But no, he couldn't even quote the Quran when it served his interests. Yeah, I should have known it. The article that was written on this says that he linked to a religious text and said, here's the entirety of this hadith. He didn't quote the entirety of it. Been no reason for him to quote the entirety of it. He just took a snippet out of context. This is what he quoted. He says, whoever shows hatred to a friend of mine, then I have declared war against him. So that's the quote. Whoever declares hatred, hostility towards a friend of mine, then I have declared war against him. It's called one of the hadith Qudsi, for the holy hadith, in which Muhammad quotes Allah saying something that is not in the Quran. They are considered on par with the Quran itself. In any case, this verse refers to being an enemy of those who are supposedly fighting Muslims, and it's why it has been drug up. So this the Muslim who did the killing in Tennessee quoted, whoever shows hatred and hostility to a friend of mine, then I have declared war on him. So, FBI, you don't need to be wondering why he acted this way. And I understand that they're trying to find every possible angle other than Islam, even though he confessed and he said, I'm doing this. I'm declaring war on those who are hostile to Islam, and that's why he picked that target. And he tweeted this or quoted this text immediately before the attack. The do-gooders who are trying to absolve Islam of culpability are now saying, well, he suffered from manic depression. Well, wouldn't you be depressed, too, if the head of your religion, the founder of your religion, was a pedophile, was a rapist, was a slave trader, was a kidnapper, was a mass murderer, a sadistic torturer? Wouldn't you be depressed, too, if you found that you have been raised within a religion that the founder is amongst the most vile people who ever lived? Wouldn't you be depressed if you found that your God spent all of his time in hell torturing people? Wouldn't that be depressing? How could you be a Muslim and not be depressed? Now, if you're a woman, you're treated like a piece of trash. If you're a man, there is no love. No reason to live, only a reason to die. I'd find that pretty depressing. Of course he was depressed. He was a Muslim. CNN reported that 3 years behind schedule and some $200 billion over its original budget, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program is finally set to become operational later this month. I would ask you, who is the United States fighting these days? Was the F-35 a tool that would have been effective in Afghanistan? With the F-35, this is the Joint Strike Fighter with all of its stealth capabilities, with all of its fighter intercept capabilities. Did we come up against an Air Force in our second invasion of Iraq? I mean, I was unaware that there was an Afghani Air Force, and if it was, it, you know, consisted of Cessna 182s, but was there, neither country had an Air Force. Neither country had a jet fighter. And we need a more sophisticated jet fighter to what? Fight non-existent jet fighters? I guess the stealth deal is you can't see our airplane intercept the airplane that's not there. That makes it really cool, I guess. The ultimate inefficiency. Our airplane's invisible when it's attacking the non-existent airplane of the enemy. So in the Libyan war, how important was a jet fighter? The Libyan have a air force? I mean, all we did was break the country. Was an air force and an intercept fighter necessary in Somalia and Yemen? How about Pakistan? Why don't you tell me how using intercept fighters of sophistication of the level of the F-35 are going to somehow make us more effective against the Islamic State? Are you going to bring an F-35 fighter to bear against an AK-47? Do you think that's a good trade-off? And what on earth is wrong with us? That we're squandering, we're bankrupt as a country, we're squandering hundreds of billions of dollars on a piece of equipment that has no value whatsoever. I'll return after a moment. The article reads, the fighter has been in development for nearly 15 years. It's weathered a half dozen years of testing and experienced a myriad of hardware malfunctions and software glitches along the way. Once it's declared ready for combat, it will be the most expensive weapons system in world history. All at a time that America is bankrupt. All at a time that America has no enemy for which this fighter will be effective. All at a time in which it's impossible even to look down the tunnel towards the future and see, perceive of any enemy for which this fighter was necessary. It was conceived to fight a foe that no longer exists. It was conceived to be all things to all people, and it ended up being just a camel, a horse designed by committee. It had to have the vertical lift capability that the Marines wanted. Well, the Harrier does that, but That makes the airplane way too heavy, way too big, and cumbersome for the missions the Air Force wants to fly in it. It has to be super rugged so that it can land on carriers. But that, again, it makes it quite different than an airplane that the Marines would want or the Air Force would want. So they wanted to have one fighter for all three, the Marines, the Air Force, and the Navy, when, in fact, they all have different missions and airplanes are all designed to accommodate different missions. So, quite the mess. And they gave the contract for the engine to Pratt & Whitney. And, no, Pratt, yeah, we can design this engine. But the problem is that when you run an engine in vertical takeoff mode and there's debris kicked up from the ground and it gets into that engine, it destroys it. So you're looking at an aircraft that even in its infancy will probably be 20 maintenance hours for every flight hour and be prohibitive to maintain. It's an engine that GE, for example, that was designing a competitive engine for it, finally said, you know, ain't worth it. You know, the number of planes the government's actually going to have built is going to be so small because the plane really has no mission. Now, it's going to be the most advanced fighter in the sky, referred to as the Joint Strike Fighter. It is touted as the most lethal and versatile aircraft in the modern era. Yeah, that's what we really needed, a more lethal aircraft. I don't know what the problem is with building roads or generating more energy or improving education, improving health care. I don't know what the problem is of doing some things that would be practical for society, dredging our rivers, making our inner cities less blighted. But no, we instead want to focus on building the most lethal fighter in the world. And you can call me if you you can think of a mission for which this new joint fighter is going to be effective. And then you can call me if you have a ideas to how we're going to use this fighter to protect against the Chattanooga-type attacks that took place a couple of days ago, or the suicide bomber that massacred the non-Muslim activists in Turkey. You tell me how you use a joint strike fighter to accomplish those things, and I'll apologize for calling it a complete and utter waste. Now, it combines advanced stealth capabilities, not that the enemy of the future will use radar, and radar jamming abilities, again, that's of no value, and supersonic speed, that's a liability in a world where the aircraft being flown by our adversaries are flying at one-tenth that speed, or one-fifth the speed anyway. An extreme agility and a state-of-art sensor fusion technology. Yeah, and that's going to be used by the dum-dums that we haven't been indoctrinating in the American education system. But after all of that time and money, supporters are no closer to quelling the detractors who blast the F-35 as a colossal waste. The fifth-generation stealth fighter plane was originally conceived in 2001 to upgrade the U.S. military's aging tactical fleet to ensure that rivals could not challenge the United States in the air. What rivals? I mean, I ask you, what rivals? I mean, you think that the Chinese are going to fly fighters to America? That the Chinese are going to try to invade America with a fleet of fighters? You think the Russians are going to mask bombers and bomb America? I mean, who are you going to be using against? Are the French or the Italians going to get frisky? You know, are the French going to stop sipping wine and get aggressive? Come on. But anyway, is it we're defending ourselves against Mexico or Canada? What rival? What foe? Who are we trying to stay ahead of? You know, it's football and baseball. Sometimes, you know, an aging superstar is signed by a team, and there's always this this realization that they are bidding against themselves. Well, good grief. Who in the world are we competing against? I mean, I understand that the Obama administration, working with NATO, has tried to recast Russia as the Cold War adversary so that we have some justification for NATO and our military spending. But the Russians have absolutely no interest in invading America and no capability to invade America. It just ain't so. This quote, air superiority is an essential tenet of our national defense strategy, says Representative Jess Miller, a Florida Republican whose districts are home to the nation's primary F-35 training facility. We have a whole host of aging air platforms, some with technology dating back to the 60s and 70s. Ain't that swell? So, what is his interest? The training facilities in my home district. Air superiority was not an issue in Iraq or Afghanistan, Miller noted. Thank you for telling the truth. But with the president's strategy to rebalance our forces back to the Pacific, and given China's territorial aggression in the South China Sea and Russia's aggression in the Ukraine, having this air superiority proves to be a strategic deterrent against near-peer threats. China is drilling for oil off some rocks. I mean, you can't even call them islands. They're just protruding rocks. And the neighboring countries, Japan in particular, is not drilling for oil around those rocks. And the Chinese just said, you know, it's within 200 miles of our coast. We're going to drill for oil here. You know, for China to say our territorial waters go out 200 miles is the same thing as the United States said. You know, there is an air defense zone and territorial claims 200 miles off our coast. The Chinese are making a lesser claim than America has made a long time ago. But the Chinese saying, you know, we're going to drill for oil off the coast of these rocks within 100 miles of our own coastline. To extrapolate from there to, yeah, you see, the Chinese are a near-peer threat, and boy, we need these fighters to deter them. You have to be absolutely a blithering idiot at that point. For you to pretend that that is a justification for this airplane. I mean, yikes. I mean, it's like that they had 50 aircraft carriers poised off our coast and that they had invaded and conquered and were occupying China or Canada and Mexico and were now poised to invade the United States. If only we didn't have this F-35, that our fate would be sealed by a Chinese military that was lurking off our coasts with battle group upon battle group and that had conquered and occupied our neighbors and was ready to pounce on America. And you justify these fighters. Because there's a territorial dispute over some rocks within 100 miles of their coast. And with Russia, you started the dadgon Ukrainian war. It's on their border. It was part of Russia for 300 years. And you're providing the intelligence and the weapon systems and the money for the Kiev regime to attack the ethnic Russians. All the while, you're tongue-lashing the Russians and reigniting the Cold War. And you're blaming the Russians for aggression and equating what the Russians have done there, which may be to have supplied some equipment, and we don't even know that for sure, to protect ethnic Russians that any one of them that's over 20 years old was a Russian citizen. And you're equating that to the Russians being poised to invade America with a fleet of battle groups and aircraft carriers off both coasts, having conquered and occupied Iceland and Greenland and Nova Scotia, and why not the Caribbean now is full of Ruskies prepared to launch their invasion into America. Good grief. Yeah, America is toast, and we're toast because of idiots like this congressman. In place of the specialized roles performed by older aircraft, the single-seat F-35, and by the way, a single-seat aircraft is a bad idea in this kind of a technology role. You know, in the commercial aviation fleet, the only airplanes that they will allow a single pilot to fly are slow, very simple aircraft. And the more complicated the aircraft becomes, the faster the aircraft becomes, the more the pilot is distracted with all manner of capabilities of that aircraft, the more they want a crew. And this, you know, business aviation makes the determination to spend money to get a larger cockpit and to get and to have a flight crew for that express purpose, that they know that that one person cannot do what two can do, and if you distribute duties, that a two-person crew is much safer, much more effective than a one-person crew. And so after spending all of this money, they've got an airplane with a one pilot managing all of these systems. Good grief, what a stupid mistake. When the big issue now is Donald Trump's failure to apologize after igniting a political firestorm the previous day by questioning as to whether or not Senator John McCain, who spent 5 years as a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War, is a war hero. Trump said, apology? No, not at all. People that fought hard and weren't captured fought hard. Boy, fought hard. What did we gain in fighting in Vietnam? Scott, can you tell me something we gained in Vietnam? What did we achieve in the fighting in Vietnam?
Nothing in the fighting, but because of Vietnam is why we have the over-the-top patriotism today.
Yeah, that's probably true. What did we gain when fighting in Afghanistan?
Nothing.
What did we gain by fighting in Iraq?
The exact same. Twice as much of what we gained in the other wars.
What did we gain in fighting World War One?
Well, it made us world power, I guess. But other than that, we didn't really gain anything.
Wow. So how is somebody a hero for endeavoring in a counterproductive enterprise? So if you're doing something that is counterproductive, how does that make you a hero? I don't get it. I mean, if I were to go off and show great courage fighting stealth aliens, they're there, you just can't see them.
I would assume you're the creator of the Mormon faith.
Oh my goodness, fought hard. Well, you know, if you were rational and exercised good judgment about the Vietnam War, you wouldn't be there. You know, if you were heroic on your thinking, you would have stood up against the war. It was counterproductive. We made a bad situation worse in Vietnam.
There are
no heroes.
It's hard for me to say Vietnam to go with the if you were you wouldn't be there thing because people were drafted. So, I mean, that's hard for me to take that angle because there were people that were there that weren't there by choice.
Yep. Yeah, I understand that.
But John McCain wasn't one of them.
No, John McCain, he was there by choice. His daddy was an admiral, and he got the opportunity to go to Annapolis, and there was a brat there, and then flew planes recklessly during training and got a chance to go play soldier in Vietnam and was shot down, probably being reckless, but he was reckless in his own personal flight while he was in training. And so he got shot down. Does being shot down make you a hero? You know, I'm going to tell you, I don't like the idea of war heroes. And so the Wounded Warrior Foundation, all that kind of stuff. Well, our military is counterproductive. It's been counterproductive for a long time. And in Vietnam, the thing that we did best in Vietnam was sending soldiers in to capture a hill that the Vietnamese had occupied against, you know, horrible odds because they were dug in stealth. And then once we captured the hill, and we'd cart our wounded away or cart our dead away and then just surrender the hill. So I'm sure that there are those that fought heroically against all odds to save their lives and save their buddies' lives. But for what? You know, I'm going to call Yosha a hero because he made a, by choice, an extraordinarily brave personal sacrifice for something worthwhile. But soldiers? You know, well, Scott, that... if you know, you had the Ruskies, and they were at the Canadian border, and they had their battle tanks ready, and they were about to invade Buffalo, New York. And somebody with a single tank stopped 300 Ruski tanks from invading Buffalo, New York. I'd call that person a hero. Has that ever happened?
No, but the whole we've gone with the same theory that Grant had throughout the Civil War with our military. We've thrown guys after guy after guy because it doesn't matter. We have more guys, or we have, you know, more stuff. That's been our tactic in wars ever since the Civil War.
Yeah, so Trump's now saying guys that weren't captured but fought hard, that they're forgotten about. And, you know, and the guys that weren't captured, they get no credit. If you want to know the truth, that's the truth, and I think that's a shame. No, the shame is that we honor warriors at all.